Number two is to acknowledge your prior misbehavior. Okay. Now, by prior misbehavior, I don't principally mean illegal things you've done that nobody knows you've done, and when they find out, you will go to prison. Okay. If you've got any of those, I urge you to seek legal counsel before you seek risk communication counsel. And that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is things that reflect badly on your company or badly on you as an individual that are already in the public domain. They are already known or knowable. So the question of whether you should continue to keep them secret or reveal them doesn't arise. They have already been revealed. Maybe the public knows, maybe the public has forgotten, maybe the public never noticed, but it's on the public record. Okay? So they're not secrets. We're talking about once it's on the public record, should you keep talking about it or should you shut up about it? Okay? Everybody see the difference between that and secrecy? Okay. Having emphasized that difference, let me mention something about secrecy. Let me talk about secrecy for a minute. Okay? The rule of thumb for secrecy is that a secret that has been revealed by somebody else does roughly 20 times as much harm as a secret that you reveal yourself. Now, that's only a rule of thumb, but it's a useful one because it enables us to do math. Okay? Given that rough estimate, it follows that if you can achieve and sustain a 95% success rate in keeping secrets, then secrecy pays. And if you can't sustain that record, then secrecy doesn't pay. So if, for example, you successfully keep 99% of your organization's secrets, then one time in 100 a secret is revealed, it does 20 times as much harm, and you're still ahead of the game. If, on the other hand, you sustain 90% success rate at keeping secrets, one time in 10 it's revealed, it does 20 times as much harm, and you'd be better off announcing all your secrets. Everybody follow that? Now, I don't know what your company's secrecy success rate is. I mean, how would I know? I don't get called about the secrets that are still secret. I get called about the secrets that have been revealed. I have sometimes said to clients, I don't think you can sustain a 95% success rate, and the client will get a gleam in their eye, and I can tell that they're thinking, God, if Sandman only knew what we have in our file cabinets. I mean, you know, we're at 99% and getting better all the time. I mean, I don't actually think so. I mean, my judgment is, at least in the developed world, I don't think it's possible to sustain better than 95%. Maybe in the developing world, if you're willing to disappear your critics, it might get possible. But I don't think your company wants to do that. So my sense is for companies that are following principles of democracy and that are behaving lawfully, it's very difficult, probably impossible, to sustain a 95% secrecy success rate. But I'm not the expert on that. You know better than I do what your secrecy success rate is. I think it's a bad risk to keep secrets, but it's not insane. Okay. Here's what's insane. What's insane is to reveal the secret and then act as if it were still secret. What's insane is to have it readily available on Google and not on your corporate website. What's insane is to put it in Appendix 7 of a technical report and not mention it at the news conference or put it in the executive summary. And the reason why that's insane is because it combines all the disadvantages of secrecy with all the disadvantages of candor. What you're doing is you are revealing the secret while allowing your critics to claim you're trying to keep it secret. Okay. You're revealing it, but you're leaving them to decide when to pounce on it, when to emphasize it, how to frame it. Okay. So in a high outrage environment, that's insane. There are only two possible behaviors with regard to bad news, embarrassing information in a high outrage environment. You keep it secret, knowing that if they find out, it'll do 20 times as much harm, but they may never find out, or you wallow in it. talking about it endlessly. The middle, okay, where you reveal it once and don't talk about it anymore, is not a viable option. The middle where you reveal it in some place you think people won't see is not a viable option. Now, the reason why this is important to emphasize is because the middle is exactly what PR tells you to do. Okay? Because PR is based on the assumption of a low outrage environment. And in a low outrage environment, if you take a PR course, they will say, don't keep secrets, you know, because it's too high a vulnerability. If you've never told anybody and the secret gets out, some whistleblower reveals the secret, it will do 20 times as much harm. You're better off revealing your own secrets. And PR people will tell you to reveal your own secrets. But they will tell you to do it once on a slow news day, preferably Friday, because nobody reads Saturday's paper. Okay? And what they're aiming for is you reveal it and hopefully nobody will know. Okay? But you can prove that you didn't keep it secret, but you haven't actually told anybody. Nobody's actually heard. That's the goal, and that's not a stupid goal in PR. Okay? So they go on to say, if you ask a PR person, what should you do if somebody did hear it and wants to talk about it? What do you do if somebody asks you about this embarrassing thing that you revealed once? And what's the answer in PR? Those of you who know PR, the answer is change the subject. And there's a term of art for changing the subject. It is called, who knows? Evasion. No, that's what the critics call it. But what PR people, or they call it spin. What PR people call it is bridging. Okay? And if you have taken a course in PR, you probably learned bridging. You know, have you stopped beating your wife? I'm glad you asked about my wife. Let me tell you about the wonderful health advocacy program she's working on. Okay? And you bridge from wife beating to other aspects of your wife that you find it more comfortable to talk about. Okay? Now, that's not insane. It's not candid, but it's not insane in a low outrage environment. You know, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can reveal the secret without anybody knowing. Okay? But in a high outrage environment, it's insane. In a high outrage environment, you either keep it secret or you wallow in it. You know, so BP, for example, for the foreseeable future, every time BP talks about health, safety, environment, they're going to have to talk about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Everywhere in the world, that was a big enough event. It'll last longer, of course, in the U.S., and longer still in the southeastern U.S. and in the states that were most affected. But you know, everywhere in the world, every time BP for the next decade or more, every time BP talks about safety and environmental issues, they're going to have to talk about the spill. Okay? Now, whatever your equivalent of the spill is, and you know, for many of you, including the one of you who came from Bougainville, but for many of you who don't come from Bougainville, that's your equivalent of the Gulf of Mexico spill. That's the memorable Rio Tinto horrible moment. But you've got others. And at each of your facility you have some. Some of them are environmental, some of them are social. A lot of them have to do with stealing land and dishonoring agreements. So you have your equivalents of the spill. They are things that people know about. And it is insane in a high outrage environment not to talk about them. You talk about them endlessly. And there is, of course, a seesaw operating here. If you try not to talk about it, your critics will talk about it all the more. If you talk about it a lot, everyone gets sick of it quicker. Okay? And you are waiting for them to get sick of it. It doesn't count for you to be sick of it. You're sick of it already. You're sick of it the moment it happens. You're waiting for people to say, I'm tired of all these mea culpas. Can we put that behind us? Okay. Let's put that behind us is always their line, not your line. Okay. Now, let me prove that quickly to you, and then I want to talk about a different aspect of number two. But first, let me prove that with a personal example, not personal to me, thank God. You are married, and you had an affair, and you feel horrible about your affair. You love your spouse. You want to stay married. You regret your affair. And you know, you end your affair and recommit to your marriage, you now have two risk communication options. Okay? You can confess your affair. Okay? Or you can keep your affair secret. If you keep it secret and your spouse finds out, it will do 20 times as much harm. But your spouse may not find out. Okay? If you confess it, you're going to have to talk about it a lot. Does everybody agree that bridging is not an option? Okay. You're not going to be able to confess your affair on a slow news day. And thereafter, if your spouse wants to talk about it, change the subject. That's not going to work. Okay. Talking to outraged people about things your company has done wrong is like talking to your spouse about your affair. You may or may not be able to keep them secret. They may already not be secret. You may think it's too dangerous to keep them secret. You may or may not be able to keep them secret. But if you're not keeping them secret, the only option left to you is to wallow in them. Okay. Now, that used to be all I would say about number two. And then I had a client that took my advice and tried to wallow in their misbehavior, and they called me up and they said, it's not working. We must be doing something wrong. We're wallowing in our misbehavior, and people are not calming down the way you said they would. You know, what's wrong? And I went back and I looked at what they were doing, and they were wallowing in their misbehavior. The problem is they were wallowing in it proudly. I had forgot to mention that when you wallow in your misbehavior, we have to be able to tell that you know it was a misbehavior. And so that it wasn't working for them. And that got me interested in the dynamics of forgiveness. So I want to talk about how to be forgiven. Do we have any Roman Catholics in the room? You know, ex-Catholics count. Okay. Oh, now we have a lot. Okay, good. The experts on forgiveness in Western society are the Catholic Church. Not that the Church is good at seeking forgiveness, but the Church absolutely understands how to grant forgiveness. And it turns out that with one exception, the secular process is identical. So I want to take you through the Catholic dogma about forgiveness. This is now going to be an ecumenical experience for you. You're going to hear Catholic dogma from a New York Jew. Okay. And step one is to admit you did it. Now, already politicians are in trouble. Politicians don't like admitting their sins. They don't, you know, they love hypothetical apologies. Whatever it is I might have done that offended people, I am sorry. Okay, Catholics, does that work? Can you go into the confessional and say, Father, I have no idea what my sins are, but I sure as hell repent? You got to have, you know, the priest will say, get out of here, come back when you have a list. Okay, you cannot repent sins that you are not prepared to identify. Okay, so you're going to have to admit that you did it. Having admitted that you did it, step one and a half, and this is one and a half because it's not in the Catholic process, step one and a half is shut up while we yell at you, which leads eventually to step two, which is to say you're sorry. Now, in the Catholic process, you can go directly from admitting you did it to saying you're sorry. God does not require time to yell at you, but people do. And this is what public meetings are for, in large measure. This is certainly what high outrage public meetings are for. What we called earlier venting is then step one and a half in the process of forgiveness. You cannot be forgiven unless people have had an opportunity to tell you what a jerk they think you are. Okay. Now, this is a big deal in the relationships between men and women. Men don't like being yelled at. They especially don't like being yelled at by the women in their lives. So men tend toward premature apology. Okay, it's one of several kinds of prematureness problems we men have. And you know what I'm talking about, right? I did it and I'm sorry. And now you can't yell at me because I already said I'm sorry. Okay. Women, does that work? No, until you're done telling him what a jerk he is, you're not willing to listen to his apology. You know, the berating has to precede the apology. Okay. Once you've been yelled at enough, then it's useful to say you're sorry, and saying you're sorry has three steps. Step one is regret. There it is. Step one is regret. Now, the word regret is unusable. The lawyers have ruined it. The company regrets to announce no longer sounds regretful. But the concept of regret is essential. We wish it hadn't happened. You know, if only we hadn't done that. Okay? You can't be forgiven without regretting what you did. Step two is sympathy, or part two of saying you're sorry is sympathy. That is, you don't just regret that it happened to somebody, and you are sorry, not sorry in the abstract, but sorry for the people it happened to. Okay, so we need to know that you have sympathy, that you have compassion for the victims of your misdeeds. Okay. And then the third part of saying you're sorry is responsibility. Now, I gave you, before the break, I gave you an example of claiming responsibility, accepting responsibility in a very powerful way with the Jack in the Box case, where the company, the supplier company, not only accepted moral responsibility, they accepted legal responsibility, they accepted liability. But sometimes you can't accept liability, or you don't dare accept liability, or your lawyers won't let you accept liability, and you still have to find a way to accept moral responsibility. And there's a spectacular example, and it's a BP example. Okay? 20 years ago, in 1990, BP had a big spill in Huntington Beach, California. It was the American Trader tanker that spilled a lot of oil off the coast of Huntington Beach, California. The CEO of BP flew to the scene of the spill, and as he was in the airplane flying to the scene, his lawyers in the plane were saying, look, under no circumstances are you to accept legal responsibility. You're not to accept liability. We have a defense here. It's not our tanker. You know, we hired the tanker company. The tanker company spilled the oil. You know, we're going to go into court and say it's their fault. Very much like BP vis-a-vis Transocean. Okay. Also on the plane were the communication people who said, come on, it's our oil. It was on its way from our oil well to our oil refinery. We hired the tanker company, and we set the specifications for safety. If we hide behind the fact that it wasn't our tanker to somehow imply it wasn't our spill, the outrage will metastasize. So what the CEO is being told is you must take moral responsibility. You must not take legal responsibility. Turns out that's not so hard. The answer was crafted on the plane. The CEO got onto the ground, held a news conference, was asked the key question, do you consider this spill your company's fault? Okay, and here's the answer. Our lawyers tell us that legally it's not our fault. But we feel like it's our fault. And we're going to act like it's our fault. Spectacular answer. The lawyers went home saying, thank God he said it's not our fault. Okay. Okay. He preserved the legal defense. And 80 million people saw that soundbite on television that night and said to each other, I can't believe the CEO of an oil company has taken moral responsibility for a spill. 6 months after the Huntington Beach spill, BP had a better reputation worldwide and even in Huntington Beach than it had had before the spill. Now, they handled the cleanup well, but that's not the big issue. The big issue is that they handled the apology well. And they did it without any increase in liability. What's stunning is that BP has forgotten that history. You know, after the Deepwater Horizon disaster, Jody actually made contact with James Ross, the CEO of BP America at the time of the American Trader spill that was so well handled. And James got back in touch with me, and you know, Jody and I both asked him, gee, isn't there some way you can, you know, get in touch with London and give them this history, share with them? There's a wonderful speech, you know, James Ross gave on essentially what went right. Give them a copy of the speech, you know, fill them in on the institutional history because they're doing this one all wrong. And he basically said they're not interested in hearing from me. There's no institutional history there and no openness to the institutional history there, which is, I think, a huge shame and very revealing about the corporate culture under Tony Hayward, who is now gone. So maybe it'll make a change for the better. What's very interesting here is ultimately BP after Huntington Beach did exactly the opposite of what BP did after Deepwater Horizon. You know, in 1990, BP took moral responsibility without taking legal responsibility. In 2010, BP took legal responsibility without taking moral responsibility. Which one worked better? 1990. I mean, not taking moral responsibility is disastrous, and BP has walked right into that disaster, in my judgment, completely unnecessarily. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, if they'd done this all right, they wouldn't be in trouble. They would, you know, I mean, you can't have that big a spill without being in trouble, but they would be in significantly less trouble if they had managed this process of forgiveness properly. Step three is to make it right. And that has two components. Part of making it right is to compensate your victims. And part of making it right is to improve. Okay. Now, you cannot be forgiven without making it right. However, order matters. Just as you can't effectively say you're sorry until you've been yelled at, you can't effectively make it right until you've said you're sorry. This is most obvious with regard to compensation. How do outraged stakeholders respond to offers of compensation in the absence of sufficient apology? Yeah, you're trying to bribe me. How dare you? And the outrage goes up instead of down. Okay? You know, my children's health is not for sale. My community's welfare is not for sale. How dare you try to bribe me? Now, if you have apologized sufficiently, they want compensation. But it doesn't feel like a bribe anymore. It feels like reparations. Okay? May feel to you like blackmail, but you're in much better shape if it feels like blackmail to you than if it feels like bribery to them. And the key to the difference is whether you have apologized sufficiently. What's stunning about this is my clients are very willing, usually, to make it right. Okay? They don't want to admit they did it. They don't want to get yelled at. They don't want to say they're sorry. But they're willing to make it right. And they're often willing to spend billions of dollars, in BP's case, $20 billion so far, to make it right, without getting any credit for that whatever if they haven't gone through the other steps first. Okay. Why do you think companies are so much more willing to make it right than they are willing to get yelled at and say they're sorry?
Personal reputations,
maybe. Well, I mean, the by far the most expensive piece of this process is making it right. I mean, that's the one with lots of zeros in it. The cost of being yelled at is quite low. The cost of saying you're sorry is quite low as long as you don't open up the floodgates of liability. And we've just talked about how you can do that. So I would say one and a half, and two, if done properly, are very cheap. Three is very expensive, and yet companies want to do three without doing one and a half, and two, especially technically driven companies. Okay. They want it over, and that doesn't work, does it? Because it won't be over if you skip steps. You know, it won't be over. You know, it doesn't end ever if you skip steps. It's endlessly able to be brought back to the public's attention. I think it's two things. I think technical people are more comfortable doing technical things. You know, and making it right is a technical activity, so technical people, you know, fine, we'll use double-held tankers. You know, Got it. We'll use double hull tankers. Or fine, we'll change, you know, the way we handle the slurry. You know, I mean, whatever the issue is, if it's a technical issue with a technical solution, even if it's a multi-billion-dollar technical solution, you're okay spending billions of dollars doing something technical. You're not as okay spending any money or even no money doing something that humanities majors ought to do, like listening and talking and getting yelled at and saying you're sorry. Those are all things technical people don't like. Beyond that, I think it's about ego. It's compatible with our egos to make it right. It's very hard on our egos to admit that we stuffed up, to get yelled at, and to say we're sorry. So for reasons of ego and sort of technical comfort, I think lots of organizations skip to step three and get no credit for step three because they haven't done the necessary precursors. Step four is to explain why it happened. People want to know, you know, how did it happen that you screwed up? What did you do wrong? What went wrong? Now, if your explanation for why it happened is a self-forgiving explanation, if you say, well, it was a bad employee, it's not really our fault, then the whole process falls apart, right? I mean, this is all about getting forgiveness for something that is really your fault. The reason this is step four rather than earlier is because anything you say early is going to sound like an excuse. So explaining why it happened before you've been yelled at, said you're sorry, and begun the process of making it right is usually going to be heard by people as giving excuses. So you want to wait until they're ready to hear your explanation of why it happened. That doesn't have to be weeks or months or years, but that might have to be at least hours or perhaps days while you're going through the earlier steps. Now, there are only two possible explanations for why it happened that admit it's your fault. Okay? One of them is evil, and the other one is stupidity. Can't think of any others, right? I mean, the evil family and the stupidity family. Either you're saying you're a bad actor, or you're saying you made a dumb choice. Okay, and those are the only options. So I want to take you on a quick catechism on the difference between evil and stupidity. First of all, which is actually more common, corporate evil or corporate stupidity? Stupidity. Okay. Which does the public think is more common? Evil. And which gets punished more in terms of your reputation? Evil. And because of those three answers, we have what I call the stupidity defense. Okay. That is, the default explanation for everything you do wrong is evil. If you don't give an explanation, the explanation the public gives itself is you're an evil corporation. The only way to preempt the evil explanation is by pushing hard and aggressively on the stupidity explanation. And if you aggressively assert your own stupidity, assuming it's true, assuming you actually weren't evil, you were stupid, it was a dumb thing you did or a dumb series of things you did, if you aggressively assert stupidity, people are willing to hear it. Okay? If you don't aggressively assert stupidity, they will assume evil. And since evil does you more harm, the stupidity defense is extremely useful. Okay. And finally, step five, Catholics, what's the last step in order to be forgiven? You must do a penance. The difference between penance and compensation is penance is all about you. You know, compensation is about your victims. Penance is about rubbing your nose in your sin, in the hope that that will make you less likely to sin in the future. And in the church, the penance is between you and God. In the secular process, the penance is between you and your stakeholders and publics. So what you're looking for in the way of a penance is a public humiliation. Okay. Now, the cheapest of all possible penances, obviously, is a sunk cost. The cheapest penance is money you have to spend anyway, And interpreting a sunk cost as a penance is a very inexpensive way of getting through this final step. You need a penance. Now, ultimately, it's not your choice. Just as you can't tell the priest how many Hail Marys to give you, you can't tell the public what your penance ought to be. It's our choice what your penance is. But you can very often propose a penance. You can even describe something that has already happened as a penance, and tick off this box relatively inexpensively. So let's look, for example, at the following situation. You have been fined. A regulator has fined you, $5 million. And the $5 million is a sunk cost. You've been fined and you're going to pay the $5 million. The only remaining question is how you talk about the $5 million. That's a very good point. You're absolutely right. Explaining why, Jody points out to me, and I don't know why you didn't just jump up and say it, but explaining why, Jody points out to me, is not really part of the Catholic process. You don't have to tell God why you did it. Is that true? I thought you did tell God what your motives were.
He already knows.
He knows. Okay. Besides, it's always the same one, right? I was weak. It's not evil and stupidity. It's weakness that the church leans toward. All right, I think that's a good point. So you paid your $5 million, and let's look at three different communication behaviors. Okay, option one: say as little about it as possible. Put it in the corporate social environment, social responsibility report, because you kind of have to, but bury it somewhere in the back. Make it as invisible as possible. Option two: issue a news release in which you say something like this. They're fining us $5 million and we're going to pay the fine. Technically, they are in the right. But it's a big fuss over nothing. We don't know why they got so upset. It was just a paperwork violation. Nobody got hurt. No harm, no foul. This isn't a big deal. But technically, the regulator is right. And, we're just going to pay the $5 million and put it behind us. Option three. This is incredibly humiliating to our company. We did something we thought would never happen. Thank God nobody got hurt. But we're not saying no harm, no foul. Somebody could have been hurt. Thank God they found it. The fine is entirely justified. This is a shot across our bow. We're checking our safety systems everywhere throughout the company to see if we have other problems comparable to this one. Because this is the kind of thing we thought didn't happen. And it did happen on our watch, and the $5 million is entirely justified. All right, now, which of those three is least common? Number three. Which gets the penitential value out of the $5 million? Number three. So if you understand the process of forgiveness, you're going to pay the $5 million anyway. Get the penitential value out of it by framing it as a penance. Don't piss it away by ignoring the $5 million or by representing it as an overreaction of the regulator. It is a chance to get forgiven. Yes?
I just wanted to know, this is externally focused, but obviously you've got to bring your employees with you on this. Are you treating them as the same as you're external-facing, you're saying this stuff at the same time, or do you think there's a different... Maybe it comes back to some of that timing, but are you addressing them at a different time, or...
You usually have to talk to your employees before you go public as much as you can. Before, maybe 10 minutes before, because these things, particularly in big stories, they don't have much shelf life. But you don't usually want to blindside your employees. You don't want your employees to find out what's going on from the media. Your employees are likely to turn into sources for the media. They're certainly going to be sources for their neighbors. So you usually want them to know what's going on earlier than other stakeholders. There are exceptions to that, but that's generally the case. As to whether what you're saying to them is the same, it depends. Sometimes what you do is an outrage to all your stakeholders, including your employees. Sometimes what you do is an outrage to your employees and nobody else cares. Sometimes it's an outrage to everybody else and your employees are outraged that you're taking the outrage seriously. So there can be employee outrage at outrage management. Why are you placating these people? Especially if some of what you're saying in order to, you know, in this apology process is, you know, or is or sounds like our employees got it wrong. You know, they did it wrong. We're sorry. You know, then employees are going to feel scapegoated, and you're going to have a second completely different outrage, or at least quite different outrage issue with your employees over having apologized for them in ways that they find offensive. So it's going to vary with the situation, but for sure, they you know, if they're not part of the picture, you got to be doing something wrong. It's very rare that you would apologize externally and have no messages internally. Yes?
Being a lapsed Catholic, I was raised in Catholic, and I remember part of this process was continuous reflective behavior and high discharge rates. And so I'm wondering if the same process could apply to a company if you're not continuously reflecting upon the consequences of your behavior and if you're not continuously disclosing your faults.
Yes. Continuously, I love the phrase, continuously reflective behavior, you know, and continuous disclosure. Essentially, keep remembering what you did wrong and keep telling us that you did it wrong. Now, I think I covered some of that, you know, when I, you know, when I talked about, you know, it's not discrete. So you're still doing one forevermore, and you're wallowing in your prior misbehavior until we're sick of it. So the continuousness is there, is in the fact that the measure of when you can stop wallowing is when your stakeholders are tired of hearing it, not when you're tired of saying it. And of course, now if you have related sins, this process gets tiring. I mean, the first time a drunk falls off the wagon and says he's sorry, it has a certain amount of credibility. The 50th time a drunk falls off the wagon and says he's sorry, he's just a drunk. And in much the same way, you know, this process is of diminishing effectiveness if you have to do it too often about the same things, not the same event, but the same error made again and again and again and again. So although the church wants you to be continuously reflective and continuously apologetic, if you are continuously committing the same sin, God may not get impatient, but the public sure as hell does. Yes, sir? Real loud.
One of the challenges, I guess, with this apology process is the concept of the company being, say, Rio Tinto doesn't really exist, but there is no entity Rio Tinto. It's just a bunch of people coming to work. And I think a lot of the time everyone in the problem just assumes that it's someone else's job to apologize, because actually it's not, I didn't do this. And I guess that's one of the challenges is, how do you actually get ownership of the problem at that individual level so that the person that can stand up and apologise on behalf of the company can do it sincerely in terms of, you know, for example, if you apologise for something that happened in the 1960s when you were before you were born, it's very easy for people to say, actually, this isn't our problem.
I mean, I have two reactions to that, and other people may have a reaction as well. I mean, the essence of the comment is it's awfully hard to apologize when you don't feel like you did anything wrong as an individual. Rio Tinto is just a collective of individuals, and if you had nothing to do with the problem, if it happened when you were in grade school or even before you were born, how can you credibly apologize for it? I have two reactions, and see if other people have any. One of my reactions is you can't apologize insincerely and make it sound sincere. I mean, I don't think anybody knows, or if they do, I guess that maybe they fooled me. But I think it's extremely tough and probably unwise to try to say you're sorry if you are not sorry. The other thing is, you know, is even though apologies come best from the person who was most responsible, and that, you know, that's a reason why Jody and I feel pretty strongly that people who screw up, if they are apologetic, should be retained rather than fired, because they can become ambassadors for what they have learned. But even though that's true, I think it's quite possible to apologize sincerely on behalf of something that you had nothing to do with, and to say that you had nothing to do with it. I think you can say, look, this happened back in the 1950s when I was in grade school, and I didn't even know about it until I came to work for Rio Tinto, which is only 2 or 3 years ago. So an apology from me may not mean much to you. But I can certainly tell you that I have read up on this in preparation for this new job I'm in, and I am aghast at what was done to you, and at what was done to your parents and your grandparents. I find it very upsetting that a company that I am working for and have come to admire and hope to keep working for did such horrible things 50 years ago, and it wasn't me. And it wasn't you. It was your forebears, and in your community, and it was my forebears in this job. But I'm here now, and you're here now, and I owe you an apology. I think that can be said very credibly. I'd rather the person who did it, limp out onto the stage and say, "Back when I was young, I did this," and But that may not be feasible. That may not be possible. And, I think you can apologize sincerely for something that you didn't do, your company did. Jody has a comment, and it sounds like you have a comment.
Isn't that exactly what the Prime Minister did when he apologized for the stolen generation?
Yes.
I think it's important that the apology not sound as symmetrical as Peter made it, because it wasn't me and it wasn't you. It was my forebears, or my company's forebears, and your forebears. But you have to acknowledge your forebears are still suffering from it, whereas I have this great job with this profitable company. This is how I feel. I'm a psychiatrist, and I once said to one of my patients, I do understand I could have a breakdown. I could become a schizophrenic or whatever. And she looked me in the eye and said, yes, but I can't become you. So it's only a one-way kind of thing. That I could acknowledge that I was trying to be empathic, that what happened to her could happen to me, but she was saying that what happened to me couldn't happen to her. So I think the apology needs to be, yes, it's happened in the past, and you're still paying the price for it. The burden of continuing to apologize for it is on me.
Yeah, I like that.